Welcome to the Australian CISO, a podcast for current and aspiring CISOs and anyone who has an interest in cybersecurity. My name is Richard. All opinions expressed on this podcast are either my own or those of the people being interviewed. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the companies that I or the interviewees are employed by. Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Australian CISO episode 36. Today is Sunday, September 17, 2023. Today's episode is jointly dedicated to my mum, who would have turned 98 this weekend, and Ron Barassi, a great footballer, coach and thinker who passed away on Saturday. Last week I attended the security conference called B-Sides Melbourne 2023. I saw a lot of great talks and spoke to a number of good people. One of those good people was Nigel Fair, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him last week. We spoke for at least half an hour, and knowing that I want to keep each episode to 20 minutes or so, I've decided to split the interview over two episodes. The first half of our discussion is contained in this episode. The second half will follow within the next week. Some notes about the interview. We definitely did not have a set of questions or pre-prepared answers. A bit like B-Sides, we just went with the flow. As a result, we did jump from topic to topic, and at one stage I did get a bit excited about risk management. Now, I could have edited certain sections out, but I've left them in as it just shows what security people talk about when they get together. So it's a little bit raw, but a bit like raw ingredients, they can combine to make some good food for thought. Ooh, see what I did there? Here is the interview. Okay, we're back at B-Sides Melbourne 2023, and I've bumped into old buddy and friend of the podcast, Nigel Fair. How are you, Nigel?
Richard, I am great, thank you.
It's good to hear. Now, what brings you to B-Sides today? Have you been a regular B-Sides attendee, or is this your first B-Sides? Tell us more.
My first one at Melbourne B-Sides, and the reason I'm here is putting my Crest Approved hat on, and we are the prize sponsor for the Capture the Flag. We're giving away a bunch of certifications and exams.
Very nice. How many exams or certifications are you handing out?
We're giving out 4 Crest Registered Tester exams to the winners and 4 Crest Registered Practitioner exams to the people who are coming second place.
Wow, very nice, if you don't mind. How did you get involved with Crest?
I started getting involved back in 2012,
yep,
when the federal government was looking for an assurance scheme. And like so many things, we go to the UK, and only not that many years before that, they had created Crest, which stands for the Council of Registered Ethical Security Testers. So it was all about pen testing. And what the Australian government wanted was exactly why the UK government created it, was organisations that were getting done over would go to the government, or the government would tell them they've been done over, and they say, will you help us fix? And they say, no, we're the government, we don't do that sort of stuff. And they go, so where do we go? And they say, well, we're the government, we can't pick winners. So what we could do as a government is, if we bring out this scheme, if you use a Crest approved member, that organisation has jumped through a lot of hoops and climbed boxes, and they're an approved organisation and have all this back end. And the people that do, say, the pen test, as it was back then only, are technically proficient because they've got a number of very difficult certifications that they've achieved. And so you are buying all about assurance. And still to this day, with the Crest-approved scheme, which is now global, chapters US, UK, Europe, Asia, Australasia, and soon to be in the Middle East. That's still what it does, is provides assurance to those in the buying community.
Oh, that makes a whole lot of sense. Now, I know, apart from your work with Crest, I think we were just discussing it 15 years ago at a conference we were both talking at, you've had, I'll call it an interesting history in the security field. Could you take us back to when it all started in the security field? And without talking for 3 hours, could you kind of walk us through each major block?
Absolutely. So it commenced in 2002 when I was a member of the Australian Federal Police.
Yep.
And we created a body called the Australian High Tech Crime Centre. And we mirrored that on the UK. It's a theme here, isn't there? Called the National High Tech Crime Unit. Except we spelt high, H-I-G-H. properly. They were HITECH.
Where were you based at this stage? Canberra? Canberra. Okay, yep.
So we kicked that off then, and it was a really interesting body. We, I think, pioneered a lot of things. So when fishing, when we investigated our first phishing attack, which is April 2003, we had secondees then come in and work with us permanently from each of the then, St. George was its own bank, five largest banks. We had secondees from every state and territory police jurisdiction working with us, from a range of other agencies. We got our technical brilliance from the then DSD. We had secondees from there. We had secondees from Customs, from ASIC, from the Bureau of Stats, because they didn't know what to do with this thing called, it wasn't even called cyber then, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
it was that proper word called information.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to protect, information security. So we had all these, this melting pot from all these different government agencies, and we tried to go, what is this thing? So I was a team leader of investigations there for 5 years. I went into the AFP's IT area.
Yep.
And worked on a big project for my sins for a couple of years to see what it's like working in IT. I did a secondment. So that's the one we could talk about all day.
Did you escape quickly?
I did. And I've never been back. I did a secondment to defense for a couple of years, and I got out of the police in 2011.
Yep.
And I did a bunch of consulting around what I would call trust and safety and confidence in the online environment.
Yep.
Before GRC was really its thing, this was like, particularly with the burgeoning e-commerce, how do you provide a safe, trustworthy and confident platform for people to interact with in all shapes and sizes? Yeah. So I did that. And I've also taught as sessional teacher at universities along the way. And then...
Did you enjoy the teaching aspect of it?
I did enjoy the teaching. Oh. Yeah.
A lot of preparation work, or did you just do it on the fly?
No.
Or
A bit of both.
Yeah.
You get caught out. You can do a conference speech on the fly, teaching for a semester. You got to have your ducks lined up.
Yeah, you've got to prepare. Yeah.
So, and then with my very good friend, Alistair McGibbon, we created the Centre for Internet Safety based at the University of Canberra in the mid-2010s. Then he went back to government. And then I ended up at the University of New South Wales for four and a half, five years running their cyber centre out of the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra. And these days, I'm a professor of cybersecurity at Monash University.
A professor? I might have to call you professor from now on. Now, one thing I've noticed from your history, you've never worked, with all due respect, it doesn't sound like you've worked in industry, as in like at a bank or at a company that we'd see in the Australian Stock Exchange. Is that just the way it occurred, or do you deliberately shy away from those big chunky organizational monoliths? Or
it's a good question, and I've done consulting into them, but you're right, it's not the same as working in them.
Yeah,
probably because I've been based in Canberra and not wanting to move. All of big roles are Sydney or Melbourne, so I've never applied for a big role or a medium-sized role sort of stuff. And I've always had enough things happening. So I do consulting for, say, for example, for the Asian Development Bank, where I write cybersecurity strategies and have done so for the central banks of Papua New Guinea, Mongolia, Bhutan, and Georgia.
Wow.
And I just, and fascinating places to travel to. Fascinating. Wow. And then I've just been recently doing some work for the World Bank. So same sort of thing. So there's always been enough to keep me busy. Yeah. And now I'm at the stage of my career where I don't want a proper job.
Okay.
And so it's one of those, if the right job came along, I'd take it. But I don't want to go back into government. And so whilst I stay in Canberra, then, as I said, the big jobs aren't there.
Yeah. Any idea what you'll do when you call it a day, when you retire? Or do you think you'll still be doing some type of part-time security consulting or something totally different?
I think I don't believe in that drop-dead date of I'm now going to retire, and I think it doesn't suit me, and I just don't think it's a good, smart thing to do. So I think I'll do less. So I'm fractional at Monash University, so I can still do all the other projects. So I will retain that for the length of I have a 5-year contract there, so I'll definitely retain that for that. Maybe go on further depending on what's happening. I've sat on a few boards over time, and I used to. One of my consulting gigs mainly was doing in boardroom briefings.
Okay.
And that was really successful until your big fat four consulting and other firms came along and started doing it for free.
Yeah.
Of course, it was never free because they sold a couple hundred grand of services out the back end, whereas I would charge them for something with nothing to come afterwards.
Yeah.
It was just the independent.
Yeah.
And really, I used to enjoy doing it, and it's a shame that it's not available anymore, because if I went around and started pitching, it'd be like, no, we've got it covered, thank you. So the board thing's interesting. Yeah, it's one of those, everyone wants to sort of sit on boards, but getting on boards, like proper boards, is so difficult.
But
competition amongst people out there, and they all want a monoculture in the boards.
Yeah.
They all want an ex-partner from a law firm or a consulting firm or someone that sat on ASX, whatever boards, and even at medium-sized stuff. They don't want diversity. I'm not even talking about diversity in what we normally think in society, but diversity of thought.
Yeah,
they just don't want any of it.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I've sat on advisory boards before, which were, I'll be honest with you, pretty simple advisory boards. I've certainly reported to boards, and the thing I've noticed about boards over the last 5 years, they're becoming really cyber savvy, and they can rip you, if you haven't done your homework, they can rip you apart in a minute. It can be quite daunting at times going to boards.
And there's lots of presentations at every conference now about reporting to the board. And as I said, lots of consultancies that are doing it and selling services. I think the whole board thing's fascinating. And the AICD has a pretty good course on for directors. And there's lots of that around there, which is great. There's also, if you Google or Bing, if you're like me, because you don't like getting the best results.
Hold on, do you still use MySpace, by the way?
I'm sure I've got an active account there somewhere.
What was the other thing? Alta Vista, Palo Alto or something.
That's right. You can go to your favorite browser and search top 10 board questions for cyber. And every consultancy and Prime, Defense Prime, everything's got it out there. Where I find the big disconnect, it's great that they've got an interest.
Hmm.
But I find two things are the issue. I find one is if they've got some sort of technologist on the board that wants to puff their chest out, and so many of them might know about, say, working in IT because they might have been a CIO somewhere.
Yep.
They're clueless when it comes to risk, and they're clueless when it comes to information security risk.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they think they know it all. Yeah. So that's the first problem, is the self-anointed expert. The second one is someone that's found one of these things and they want to ask you questions to make themselves sound techie.
Yeah.
And invariably, they don't ask value-added questions.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we get down to things like, you know, what's our firewall brand?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it's like, but you don't need to know about that. You'll hear about top end of town governance and strategy and risk things, you know. It's the same with all those board reports of, you know, and vendors are the worst at this thing. We blocked 90 million malware samples last month, you know.
Yeah.
Is that good? I don't know.
I want to mention something you mentioned, and I had this discussion, let's say in the last couple of years, we'll say, and it was all about, it's all about the data, right? And we're talking about, oh, you know, Nigel stores data on his work laptop. And I would, and oh, and that's a risk. So, okay, let's break that down, what we mean by a risk. It, the risk isn't the fact that you're storing data. The risk is a statement, something like the unauthorized access to that data. And so there'll be a likelihood and there'll be a consequence. But let's look at the controls. Nigel's laptop has encryption, BitLocker encryption, or whatever it is.
A strong password.
So if his password, if Nigel's PC gets left on the train and I just happen to be the big hacker that I am and find the password, find the PC, keep on calling PCs passwords. Anyway, got passwords on my brain at the moment. So if I'm the big hacker on the train, I find Nigel's PC and I open up and I get the disk.
Well, you could be agnostic and say laptop.
All right, laptop. All right, also.
I'm a Mac fanboy.
it wouldn't be a desktop. I find a desktop. Anyway, and I rip out the hard drive and all that. The hard drive's encrypted. To me, there is very minimal risk compared to an unencrypted laptop. So why are, I think I know the answer to my own question, why are companies getting so obsessed with, oh, there's information in his laptop? If it's encrypted, personally, I've got a semi-big risk appetite. I don't care. The fact that it's encrypted, no one's going to be reading that information on the PC. And this is where I think a lot of companies get really, oh, the risk. Define what you mean by risk and really break it down. Because once you break it down, there's a major control here. Oh, in case so it's not a risk. No, the likelihood's probably low. The consequence might be high, like a plane hitting this building we're in at the moment. But likelihood's low, consequence high. Likelihood's low. The controls are so strong, it's such a low risk. But I don't think organizations still understand risk management. That was a long way of saying I don't think companies understand risk management.
Yeah, no, I agree. And from my experience is they don't want to dedicate the time to going through the scenarios and doing a risk assessment.
Because it does take time, doesn't it?
It does take time. But all they want to do is rush to what framework are we going to use? Are we going to use 27001? Are we going to use NIST? So weirdly, in my consulting days, sometimes I find all they want to do is just do a gap analysis between what's the latest version of 27001, 96 controls or some sort of
114.
Thing like that.
Just off the top of my head, 114.
Do a gap analysis for that, and they think that's their risk assessment.
Yeah.
And then we're not very good as an industry sometimes of against countering about that. And the classic is MFA.
Yep.
So, you know, I'll be talking to an organization and I'll say, we've read the federal government's advice and it says in the Essential 8 we should have MFA.
Yep.
And that's important. And then so they bring in a vendor and they have MFA, but it might be SMS MFA, which is probably not the best MFA.
Yep.
But explaining that to them, I've found is a waste of time because they hand on their heart go, the government advice is this. We brought in a vendor that said that. We have MFA. And you can't say it's not MFA. Yeah. It's definitely MFA. But trying to explain what the best MFA is, I think as an industry, we're not very good at that. Because it goes back to you saying about risk.
Yeah.
Is it for a laptop like that, it might be fine on the risk assessment. Or if it's got, if they're a dev and it's got all the keys to the kingdom on it, then you want a better MFA that costs a few more bucks per user per month.
I think the key is, which you've alluded to, and I think what you're really good at doing, is just explaining it in plain English. But to be fair, you can explain anything in plain English, but if you're a board or an organization that we don't want to hear this, or they've got their own set mindset, then you can talk in as much plain English as you want. Sometimes it's hard to get the message through. They will not accept it because they know more than you, the cyber person.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll say in their defense is when I've done the bigger boards, they meet for a whole full day, sometimes more. And they've got a board pack inches thick. And then all of a sudden, there's some guy coming to add another thing to their day. And it's like, really? Do I actually need this? You know, how quick can you be?
Yeah. And on another occasion, perhaps we should, not now, but we should talk about board reporting and what's the best way to get the message across. Which reminds me, I have created, and I'll share it with you later, I have created a really one-page, easy-to-use, high-impact board dashboard that I think could be an absolute winner. And so sometime in the future, after my board have approved it, I will release it to the public. Because we're all, you know, we know it's people, process, and technology, but it's also that partnering and cooperating
together. Yeah, and obviously the big chatter now is about third parties.
Well, that was just a couple of old blokes going on and on and on about various aspects of security. And with third-party questionnaires, I think we'll take a break from our discussion until next episode. Next week, we'll finish off the interview with Nigel. Then in the following episode, we'll have part one of another long discussion I had with someone at B-Sides. Until the next episode, I say goodbye and I wish you all the best. Speak again. Look after yourselves. Bye. This podcast is written, produced, and presented by myself, Richard Herron, and hosted on Podomatic. Any statements I make are my own or have been attributed to the originator. My personal views are mine. They do not necessarily reflect the views of my employer. Any views expressed by guests are their own and should not be associated with the organizations they work for. The podcast is recorded using Audacity, using a Rode Podcaster microphone. The music is provided by Pixabay. The music is called Pluck Loop, 91 beats per minute, and here it is for your listening pleasure.